Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We usually begin with emails, and this time we're going to do something a little different and begin with some of the many comments that we received online just within the last week on TikTok. And I know a lot of our listeners out there are not on that platform. I myself do research there. I'm not there privately, personally. Mm-hmm. Gabe, you're not on there. However, we do post, or some of the things we talk about on the show, we also talk about there. And then sometimes we talk about things there that we don't talk about on the show. And this is one of those cases. And I'm just going to start by reading one of the comments, which says, why are we comparing mental health medication to heroin? And when she writes this, she doesn't mean we, like Gabe or I or all of us, we're not doing that. Most people are not comparing mental health medication to heroin, but somebody very prominent was.
That was the video that we published last week. It was about RFK Jr. and a statement that he had made about SSRI antidepressants. And what he was saying there in that statement, this was a few months ago or last year when he said it, was that someone in his family who had been on an SSRI, it was harder for that person to get off of the SSRI than it was to get off of heroin. It was one of a number of occasions where he has, he's stigmatizing the use of these antidepressants, this medication for not only depression, but also anxiety, mental health issues, stigmatizing it, speaking out against it, giving people, making it confusing for people who might need these medications, whether they should be taking them. And one group in particular where that confusion can be a real problem is pregnant women, because there is research on what happens when pregnant women go off of SSRIs for mental health issues. You relapse. It's five times more likely for you.
And let me just jump in there, because relapse usually means drugs or alcohol or some other addiction. In this case, it means the anxiety or depression you were suffering previously and which may have been mitigated or medicated away through those SSRIs comes back.
We're not talking about the effect that the SSRI has on the anxiety or the depression. We're talking about what happens when you go off of that. And the reason why we are talking about pregnant women and SSRIs is that the FDA and RFK Jr. has full control over what the FDA does. They convened an expert panel this summer to look into SSRIs and pregnant women and the effect on the baby that SSRIs has. And on that panel, there were 10 people who had a clear bias against the use of SSRIs by pregnant women. And that's why we did the video.
And stigmatizing the use of those drugs during a pregnancy.
The experts on that panel did that on a number of. There's an hour and a half video of the panel. You can watch that on YouTube. Yeah, just and see for yourself the way they talk about the use of SSRIs by pregnant women. It's not good, and it's not based on rigorous science, and that's the real problem.
The science is associative or
observational at best.
Yeah, at best, and not causal, and it is contradictory at this point. So I think the message that you ended with there, which should be repeated, is if you or anyone you know is considering having a child and is on these medications or may be on them, that they should go and talk to their doctor and not be confused by statements coming out, often from very powerful people.
And backed by science. A lot of scientific studies are quoted or are used as basis for these comments. There are none. There are none out there. So if you hear anyone claiming how dangerous it is for you to take these medications or how good it is to take these medications, those are not scientific statements.
Yeah. You're welcome to take a look on TikTok if you want to venture there or if you're already there. It's DW Science on TikTok, and there you can read some of the comments. A lot of, in particular, women writing in to say how, it's anecdotal, it's their personal experience, how they themselves felt during their pregnancies, trying to go off or staying on these medications or just weighing in and saying, look, the benefits at this point do outweigh the negatives. Mm-hmm. So a mother that is in a severe mental health crisis is worse than one who's not. And at this time, talk to your doctor and listen to your doctor's advice. Going to move on to some very different science now. And it begins here with a questionnaire, Gabe. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing with you, mm-hmm. but part of it. Gabe, which hand, you've got two of them, which hand do you
prefer? Oh, which of my own hands? Or yeah. like which hand in the world?
Are you familiar with the hands of the world? No. Which hand is the question do you use when using a toothbrush?
Both.
Really?
Depending on which teeth I'm going at. First of all, let me just give some context. I have periodontal disease, so I take dental hygiene very seriously. I brush for like 5 minutes a night. And when I'm going for the right uppers, then I use my right hand because I can get at them better. When I'm going for lower...
Wait, your left uppers would be the right hand?
Yeah, but then I've got a better angle with my right hand. And on the other side, then I've got a better angle with my left. So
okay.
both.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm a dexterous there.
Okay. Using a broom?
I got the left hand lower.
Okay, so your right hand is doing most of the pushing, most of the, okay, yeah. the manipulating.
Yeah.
Holding a computer mouse.
Right, no doubt right.
Using a key to unlock a door.
Right.
Holding a hammer?
Right.
Yeah, so you are right-handed,
yeah. Correct? Well, you could have just asked me if I'm right-handed.
Well, no, I wanted to put you through the questionnaire that more than 1,000 people were put through.
Okay.
And this is the gold standard of what's called handedness, trying to determine, are you left-handed, are you right-handed, or are you somewhere in between?
Okay.
Established in 1971, the Edinburgh Handedness Inventory. You can look it up online and do it yourself if you'd like. And what they're measuring there is something called the laterality quotient. And what has been proven time and time and time again is that roughly of everyone out there listening right now, 9 out of 10 of you are going to be right-handed. 9 out of 10. 1 out of 10 is going to be left-handed. We'll get to that in a minute. But first of all, why so many right-handers?
There could
be another world where it's 50-50, right? That would also seem logical. And yet 90% are right-handed.
Okay.
Why?
Where is this going, Connor?
Hang with me for a while. We're going to end up taking a look at left-handers here in just a second. But right-handers, the reason for this, it's called the evolutionarily stable strategy. And the idea here is basically that in a war, it's more efficient to have everyone doing one thing. And whether it's a doorknob or scissors or table, if everyone had used the same hand, the world operates more smoothly. And the other way of looking at that is I actually went up, I have left-handers in my family. I've heard their complaints, but I looked online at some of the common complaints from left-handers. Yeah. And scissors is the one that jumped out at me. It's writing, because the ink gets smeared by your left hand. Left-handers always have that ink smeared on that. What is that? Outside the pinky?
They have to have their palm at a different angle so that doesn't happen. Yeah.
And if you remember those college, what are called college desks that have it, like the small part of it, it's a tiny desk and it's on the right side.
What are you supposed to do
then? Miserable is that? Can openers was also on the list. And then my favorite personal thing that is the most annoying part of being left-handed is apparently having people seeing you write something and they say, oh, you're a lefty?
Yeah, you can see it because of the slant, yeah.
Yeah, and then everyone has to, you have to deal with that.
This was the topic of a Simpsons episode when Ned Flanders opened up the Leftorium, a store where that only sold these objects for left-handers.
It makes sense because...
When C. Montgomery Burns buys a roadster at the end for like $100,000 with a left-handed stick shift.
Well, that would make sense. Probably more to you now, knowing, as I just found out, that Matt Groening, the creator of that show, is left-handed.
Well, of course, that's where it came from. Yeah.
He's on a list that includes Aristotle, Leonardo da Vinci, Albert Einstein, Mother Teresa, Paul McCartney, Lionel Messi, no big surprise there, left-footed as well. Mm-hmm. What surprised me, LeBron James, the NBA basketball player, shoots right-handed. And so I was like, no, this list has to be wrong, but is left-handed in every other aspect of his life. The same with Rafael Nadal,
sure,
tennis player, is left-handed, but his coaches were like, hey, you should switch. And so now he's right-handed. Beethoven, Michelangelo, Lady Gaga, Joan of Arc, Napoleon Bonaparte. Lots of people are left-handed. Part of the reason I need to do this is because it's kind of a reminder that left-handed people are good people, too. And
was that in question?
Historically, yes.
Oh.
Left-handedness, depending on the culture that you grew up in, it was associated
course,
with being
a... You're different.
You're a witch. You are more impure. There's a long history of left-handers being judged simply for being left-handed, and that gets kind of into the study. Why would this be? Why would 1 out of 10 people have this? And there was a theory that had not been substantiated by science. And the theory was that, well, and I'm going to quote the paper here, individuals with a bias in the opposite direction, so you're a left-hander, could have the advantage of surprising others in competition, being they're directionally less frequent in the population, and thus they might adopt strategies to which opponents are less accustomed to. So in an age where fist fighting or weapon use was a life or death scenario that might happen to you in real life, yeah, being left-handed was a real advantage.
Because all these right-handers don't know what to do. Whoa!
We've practiced
this hand coming at from the other direction.
You've practiced your whole life.
I know how to block those right-handed hooks, but...
Yeah, not the left-handed ones. Yeah. And this also makes sense in today's age, right? If you have a sport that is traditionally right-handed, a left-hander is just something different, or even a left-footer, depending on what sport that you're going to play.
Baseball pitcher, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and now onto the experiment itself. They took 1,000 people. This was the, I got to look it up again, because I'd never heard of this place in Italy, although like a lot of places in Italy, it looks nice. This is the University of Chieti Pescara, mm-hmm, which is like, if Italy's a boot, this is the back zipper, kind of, on the backside of the boot. For that experiment, all they were doing is that first survey that you did, are you left-handed or are you right-handed? And then they were also measuring how competitive you are. They're kind of looking into like aggression, competitive, to see, is there a connection between people who, and I have to say, survey themselves as a left-hander, and how they rate themselves in terms of competitiveness.
So they asked these people, how competitive are you? And then looked at whether they were right-handed or left-handed, and then wanted to see what happened? Or?
Yeah. And there was and I'm going to quote the paper here, is that there's a stronger left-handedness was positively related to self-developmental competitive orientation. And this sort of connects back to that theory of this being an evolutionary mechanism to help with situations of aggressiveness or violence. And then also, this is the last part of the study here, and my favorite part actually is, they're like, well, a survey is subjective. Are you telling the truth? You try to tell the truth. Do you know yourself that well? How do we make that objective? They took something called the 9-hole peg test, and I was just watching a bunch of videos of that online to see how that worked. It's basically, you have like a small bowl with mm-hmm. 9 pegs in it, mm-hmm. and then you have 9 holes in the shape of a square. And they start the clock, and you grab them with your right hand and put the pegs in the hole, and then you take the pegs back out, and that's it. How long does that take? And then you do it with your left hand.
Oh, this was to verify whether they were truly right-handed or left-handed.
Yes.
How do you verify the answer or check whether the authenticity of the second question, are you competitive? How do you lie about that?
Sorry, if I phrased that wrong before, that stayed the same.
Okay.
This was to take an objective measure of left or right-handedness and then kind of compare it up against that. And what they found is there's zero correlation there.
I'm trying to think right now, at night when I'm brushing my teeth, am I better with my left hand or with my right hand? Now that you mentioned that, I don't know.
Yeah, you're somewhere.
And I've got an electric toothbrush, so it's not really all that hard. All you got to do is, I guess, brush it against.
Oh, you've gone full electric.
Yeah.
I
said, my dental hygiene is really important, but I'm saying for them to be the same exact speed or just as fast, that means that you're just as good with your left hand as with your right hand? Do you guys feel like that's the case?
At putting pegs, and these pegs, for anyone who's put IKEA furniture together.
That can be really hard.
You know, you have to slide it in one hole and then put the other piece of the furniture onto that hole so the peg holds it all together.
Oh.
It's that kind of, yeah. Apparently, this particular exercise, which is usually done for to see where people are at in terms of multiple sclerosis. So a lot of neurologists out there will be like,
that's a good
course,
test of mobility and motor skills.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can watch and see if there's any progression in the neurological decline over time with the left hand and the right hand. And is this, hemispheric? How is this happening to the person? It's a very useful test in its own right, but it turns out that particular test doesn't necessarily, at least in the case of this study, have a connection to whether you think you're right-handed or left-handed. That's just one of the accidental byproducts of this research.
And what do you guys think about the idea that left-handers are more competitive inherently than right-handers? Can you verify that or confirm that anecdotally? Or are you left-handed?
Yeah.
Give us a sense of what you feel about that, if you could.
Yeah.
By writing suedw.com. That's how that works. Do you get the chills when listening to music? You're affected. It affects you so strongly that your body goes into this sense of, I don't know, you're tingling. It's so emotional, or it's so deep, or when reading poetry, or can art have that effect on you? That's the topic that we're going to look at in a little bit. But first, we went to the streets of Bonn, Germany, to get a sense of, does this happen to normal people, to Germans?
My name is Anna.
And Anna, how old are you?
I'm 40 years old. I get the goosebumps when I listen to some music, not all music. I'm very moved. Maybe I get tears in my eyes, and I feel glad and very, very good feelings.
I think I get mostly goosebumps at exciting moments, for example, when I got accepted to the university here, or scary art or dark art, paintings which are a bit not that colorful, but more on the darker side. So
No.
And never in your whole life, you've never been listening to a song where you get this creepy crawly feeling up your whole body, and you kind of and you can see it.
No, I cannot remember one time, really.
As we heard there from Judith, it does not happen to everyone. And the question is why? Why would some people get affected by art in a way that forces their body, makes their body tingle or chill up, and some people don't?
Science Unscripted.
I am Giacomo Bignardi. I'm a researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Empirical Aesthetics in Frankfurt. And together with colleagues from the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics in the Netherlands, we publish a study on the genetics of chills from art, music, and poetry.
Let's just be clear first and foremost on what we're talking about here. You're talking about the goosebumps that people feel when they're listening to music, or what exactly?
I think this is a great question, because it's a great misunderstanding. The goosebump, or the hair standing on end when someone is listening to music, is an experience that can co-occur with chills, but doesn't need to. So chills is that tingly sensation, that shiver, that subjective but physical experience that people have while listening to music, a very emotional passage, or while also sometimes looking at art or reading poetry that they like. But they do not need to be classic goosebumps.
And what did you find out about in your study?
So in our study, we found that people that are more genetically similar are also more likely to experience this type of chills from music, from art, and from poetry.
What does that mean, genetically similar? People who look like me, act like me, talk like me? What is that?
Yeah, so the idea is that you can use data on DNA variation, so DNA variants, and you can see that people that have more similar DNA variants on the part of the genome that differ between individuals, they are also more genetically similar. And that's the relationship that we found. More genetic similarity, more shared genetic variants, more likely to experience chills from art, poetry, and music.
You looked at 15,000 Dutch people for this study, is that right?
Yes. So together with Lifelines, who is a multi-generational cohort from the Northern Netherlands, we looked at two simple questions, whether they get chills from art and poetry and whether they get chills from music. And the catch is that some of these individuals were actually coming from the same family. So now we have a problem or an opportunity. We have genetic variation, but we also have individuals that come from the same family, from the same environment. So environmental effect, familial effect, might hitchhike genetic variation. So the question is, are we finding association with genetic variation, or are we finding association with familial effects? So we used a two-step approach in which we were actually able to account for this familial relatedness. And even after accounting for this, we were able to find that at least 7%, in our case, a seemingly precise measure, but there is much more to say about it, of the variability between individuals was indeed associated with the DNA variation.
Is that another way of saying that family and environment matters far more?
I would say that family does matter, indeed. But with our study, it's very difficult to say whether the remaining variance is indeed due to family effects or is a consequence, for example, of the technology that people use to genotype the individuals. We don't have the full genome covered, for example. Whether it's an interaction between familial effect and variants that people inherit from their parents. And also a very simple explanation that the listener will not like to hear, but it might be just measurement error. The measure that we used was just a simple question. And with that question comes a lot of noise that we can't capture using genetic measures.
I share a lot of the interests that my brother has more or less taught me what to like when it comes to music. And I'm wondering, that came a lot from him being my brother, but also from us sharing the same genes? Is that what you're saying right now? Is that the effect that Krishan Borud has had on what music I like? It's more than him just being my brother.
So you're asking two questions, and both of them are great. So the first question is like, of course, to answer to your question, I'll try to give you an alternative scenario. Imagine that you were completely insensitive to music. You were not able to feel anything, regardless of the type feel of music. For you, music was just like abstract patterns. The interaction that you would have had with your brother might have been, in this counterfactual scenario, different, right? But the fact that you felt something, and the fact that your brother felt something, and the fact that you shared that experience together, it might have been something even more important for you.
When do you get the chills from music?
I don't. So I don't really get chills from music. That's a shocking revelation during the show. Yeah, I just don't really get chills from music.
And why are you studying this then?
I think, like, you know, when people come to me and they are telling me they're getting chills from music, or other people are telling me, are you crazy? You're telling me that people get chills from art. Everyone gets chills from music. It's just that when we are in our own sensory bubble, we believe so much that what we experience is shared with everyone else that we forget that these things are sometimes unique experiences and some people do not have them. It's like being colorblind. It's like having synesthesia. People inhabit a completely different world. And I think music, it's a very nice window, and especially studying the genetics of the experience with music and art is a very nice window into these type of differences.
Is it fair, based on your work, either this paper or work you've done in the past, to say that the people out there who don't get the chills from any kind of art, they're not Philistines, they're not people who are undereducated or hate art or can't understand it because they're stupid, that there is just possibly something, they were born that way. It's just some people have it and some people do not, and it's nobody's fault.
I'm not going to give a definite answer on they were born with it. It is possible. Our study indeed showed that genetic variation plays a role into this type of phenomena. I wouldn't say that I'm uneducated and I don't feel chills from music, for example. So if you don't feel chills from music and you're listening to this, we are together in this. And also something else that we didn't discuss about, but it's also important to reflect, there are people that experience chills from music, but they don't experience chills from art and poetry, and that's fine. But the other way around, even if you're a bit more rare, it's also true. In the paper, in the introduction of the paper, I cited Nabokov talking about the tele tingle that he was referring to when appreciating the work of genius. But Nabokov himself was someone that didn't really resonate with music much, let's put it this way. So I feel there is a lot of diversity in the world, and it's completely fine to appreciate it.
I can vouch you are a wonderfully articulate and sophisticated human being, Jaco. And what you're saying is to our listeners that you don't have to worry if you don't get the chills or don't get swept away by art. There's nothing wrong with you.
Absolutely.
And that was Giacomo Bignardi in Nijmegen, Netherlands, there talking to us from the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics.
Yeah, sitting there with Jaco, I was wondering, you asked that question a couple of times, and also we talked about it after the mics went off. What is the point of this research? What are we trying to figure out? And for me, personally, it boils down to the question, what is the point of art? To force yourself into this situation where you're almost physically affected by it? Because I remember doing that in college, searching for the kinds of music that took me there. Pink Floyd was one of them.
That gave you the aesthetic chills?
That gave me those chills. I was searching for it. And a few weeks back, it had happened to me out of the blue. I was watching an ad for one of these smartphones. And the point of the ad was that a father was using this phone to film his daughter as she was trying to learn snowboarding. And the ad ended with him filming her winning the gold or some kind of gold medal. It was during the Olympics. So that was kind of the theme. And during this, the whole time, that Golden song, the K-pop Demon Hunter Golden song was playing. And by the end of it, when he was filming his daughter getting this gold medal, I had the chills so bad. It was in my mouth. I don't know where I'm going with this, Connor, but I
know what you're saying. I get it too. I feel a little, I don't know, mixed emotions when it's for a private corporation that is trying to make a lot of money by making me feel that way. I think that's the difference between an ad like that.
It was very manipulative. They took the music.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But if you want to get back to art for art's sake, which is a huge question that I'm not qualified. I can't answer that in any way. Art can do a lot of. It can cause you to change the way that you see the world. Now you're looking at it from a different perspective, and that will not necessarily give you aesthetic chills. There's something else that seems to be happening, right? When those chills happen, a certain combination of elements. And the purpose here wasn't to talk about what exactly that is. If you could figure that out, if it's a combination of chords in music, if it's a dissonance that then gets resolved, or yeah, something that hangs for long enough that you're waiting for it to be resolved and therefore you get the chills, it's almost terrible to know that, because then it'd be in every song, on every album, just to give you the chills, and then you would stop getting the chills. And also interesting, yeah, we didn't talk to him about that, but the fact that if I've done this to myself, where there's a song that gives you the chills, and so you listen to it again and again and again, and until it does not.
I've done that to myself. Yeah, I've ruined a lot of music by listening to it too much, because I'm going after that feeling.
Yeah,
when that happened to me, that is a very pleasurable feeling, to be gripped to such an extent by art, and then to find out today it doesn't happen to everyone. They're trying to figure out, researchers like Giacomo are they're trying to figure out why this happens to some people and why it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And
to go back to your original thought, what is the point of all this? I think the most important message for all of you, it is not a factor of you understanding more about art or being more intellectual or more educated, and hence that's why you can feel what you're feeling. It's not that. You just got genetically lucky if you can feel it, probably, or were raised in an environment that allowed you to be open to that experience. It might be all of those things, but the person who can't, not only don't judge them for that, but have empathy for them. I mean, I'm happy I get those goosebumps. I really am.
Are you guys happy? Do you get them? Do you not get them? Where do you stand on the aesthetic chills debate? Let us know at sudw.com.
DW, made for minds.